I know this is Sunday, obviously the day we worship, gather together and worship as God's church, God's people. But also, this is a day that a lot of us, and most of us are even wearing green. We're celebrating people celebrate a man, Saint Patrick. And I don't want to get into a lot of history there, but one of the things that is very neat about this man is that he was arrested at a very young age and taken into captivity and brought to Ireland as a captive. He was a prisoner there. And for 16 years, he lived there as a prisoner. And while a prisoner in that land, he felt God speaking to him. And this is kind of how he wrote a letter, and that's what it said. He felt God speaking to him, saying this, that he needed to reach this land for Christ. And he wasn't from a very religious family. He didn't know a whole lot, but one day in his sleep, he dreamed, and God, he said he heard God talking to him, saying it was time to go. It's time to leave. So he walked 200 miles out of Ireland, and he started to learn. He got and became a bishop, and he was sent back to Ireland to be a missionary. He wasn't the first Catholic priest there or bishop there to teach Christianity to those people, or the Catholic way of things, but he was somebody that kind of renewed it. It was a country riddled by paganism and just Celtic beliefs that meant they would dance around fires, big bonfires, and wear animal skins and worship animals and other gods. And he used and he incorporated all of these things in a missional way to teach people about Jesus, to teach people about Easter, to teach people about all these things. He used the bonfires that they used in their pagan religion and their festivals to teach people about Jesus. And greater than this man is Jesus, and he knew that and he believed that. Jesus Christ is our Savior. He is the most glorious missionary ever, the most heartbroken for his people ever. Saint Patrick is simply a man that was fallen, a sinner, and hopefully redeemed, but had a vision of his God and knew his God. So this morning, as we celebrate, and many of us wear green and we think about this man, let's think about Jesus. Let's think about the greatest missionary ever, the greatest heart ever for a lost people, a lost world, people that danced around campfires and worshiped false idols. Because we all have those idols, and we all had those idols, and Jesus saved us from them, if you're his child. So I just wanted to say that opening up that, if we're wearing green, it's not a sin, and if it's not necessarily a Catholic thing. He preached Jesus. He did. So let's open just with prayer and get going. Father, I thank you for your son Jesus. I thank you that he was the greatest and is the greatest missionary ever to come. God, that his heart was full of obedience to your word, that obedience brought joy, that you had a plan greater than this world had ever known. God, he followed you through everything. He followed your words. He followed your guiding. He followed you when everything seemed to I'm sure, not make sense in an earthly way to him. Because he constantly had his eyes on you. As his body was weak and beaten and torn apart, he followed you. Father, as many of us have felt at times as prisoners, isolated by ourselves, captives, help us to be like St. Patrick, to listen to your voice and to follow you. Even if that means walking away from everything we've known, because we realize we're captives. That whatever that thing that's holding us there, whether it's an idol or oppression or whatever, that we can walk to you, we can follow you. God, for those of us here this morning that don't know Jesus, we haven't believed in the cross, we haven't believed in its power, we haven't believed in Jesus' death there, we haven't believed in his resurrection as full payment and as liberation from our sins, our death, our penalty that we bear because of who we are. God, I pray this morning that you would just use your word, that you would use these moments to awaken them. You would send your spirit to them. You would convict them of sin. You would convict them of Jesus and the cross and the resurrection, and you would save them. Father, once again this morning, I ask that you would remove from myself any motives, any intentions that aren't yours, that aren't godly, that aren't of your grace and your wisdom. God, and that you would shine forth through your word. I love you and I praise you this morning in your beautiful name. Amen. Psalm 77. To the choir master, according to Jehudatha, the psalm of Asaph, I cry aloud to God, and he will hear me. In the day of my trouble, I seek the Lord. In the night, my hand is stretched out without wearying. My soul refuses to be comforted. When I remember God, I moan. When I meditate, my spirit faints. You hold my eyelids open. I am troubled that I cannot speak. I consider the days of old, the years long ago. I said, let me remember my song in the night. Let me meditate in my heart. Then my spirit made a diligent search. Will the Lord spurn forever and never again be favorable? Has his steadfast love forever ceased? Are the promises at an end for all time? Why has God forgotten to be gracious? Has he in anger shut up his compassion? Then I said, I will appeal to this, to the years of the right hand of the Most High. I will remember the deeds of the Lord. Yes, I will remember your wonders of old. I will ponder all your works and meditate on your mighty deeds. Your way, O God, is holy. What God is great like our God? You are the God who works wonders. You have made known your might among the peoples. You with your arm redeemed your people, the children of Jacob and Joseph. When the waters saw you, O God, the waters saw you, they were afraid. Indeed, the deep trembled. The clouds poured out water. The skies gave forth thunder. Your arrows flashed on every side. The crash of your thunder was in the whirlwind. Your lightnings lighted up the world. Your earth trembled and shook. Your way was through the sea. Your path through the great waters. Yet your footprints were unseen. You led your people like a flock by the hand of Moses and Aaron. Now, I simply wanted to just kind of read through this psalm. We're still in Psalm 42, 43. I wanted to read through this psalm because you kind of get the same feeling that God is gone. In the middle of this song, and that Asaph is writing to God, he is painting a picture for us that God is nowhere to be found. His steadfast love. And don't ignore the words that these psalmists and God uses in the scriptures. His steadfast love was gone. It felt to be gone. And have you forgotten to be gracious, he said. Have you shut up your compassion? You can feel the heart of the psalmist just riding and saying, where are you at? The God I remember, the God I know, the God I have felt before, where have you gone? Where have you gone? And then once again, like we saw last week, you see this kind of this inner preaching to your soul, reminding yourself that this God that I worship and I know and I adore and is my joy, he is much more than the simple feelings of life. And he begins, he begins to trace back and see that God is in all things at all times. That sometimes God's way is incredibly difficult and by our standards, doubtful that it would work. And he brings up at the end Moses and Aaron, how they led them through the Red Sea. By the hand of God, he parted the Red Sea and they walked through on dry land. And that was a miracle, but indeed it seemed impossible to them at the time. Do you remember what happened to the people as they were cornered there? What many of them were beginning to do? What arose in their hearts and their souls was doubt. God felt absent. And I bring this up because many times we as God's people, we end up in that place. Just like last week. We feel like God has left. He's not with us. And I use some of my own examples. And since last week, have any of you experienced God sending you through trials because you have just learned about Him being your true joy, your source of true joy? Did you feel darkness creeping in? It's been, and I can't remember if I said it last week at all, but it has been sort of that sensation in my life. I had mentioned that there for a while, it seemed like everything was amazing. Me and Abby, our relationship was better than I could ever remember it being. And then since I began to pour in and start to think about how I wanted to present these feelings and these emotions and these truths in this passage, God began to allow me to really lean on those truths. Me to really dig in and believe by faith these emotions and these feelings aren't given by worldly means. And I felt that darkness creeping. But by God's grace through it all, I've asked myself this question that this psalm teaches. Why are you downcast? And we talked about that last week. So last week, just to condense it, the psalmist, he gave no purpose. If you remember, I kind of mentioned this. He gives no purpose for the psalm, for this song. You understand that it's a song. It's supposed to be, it's a mascal, which is really a term we don't know. And throughout the words in the song, you don't get a very clear idea of exactly what is happening. And I talked a little bit about tradition kind of holds for some people, they kind of lean towards David and when his son had betrayed him and he had fled the country. People kind of lean towards that, but what I found most impressive is that God didn't put that here. And so that these words, this song can touch us, our lives, when we are in that dark place, whatever that dark place holds for us. If it's just simply a feeling when God is absent, just like Psalm 77, if it's just like God is gone, His grace is gone, His compassion is gone, His steadfast love seems to be gone. So these words can speak to us in that place. We don't break them down because, well, David was threatened to be murdered and he was going to lose. He's lost his power in his country. He's not near the temple anymore. He feels like that's a place of worship and I don't connect there. That's not part of this song. God didn't write it that way. And so I do feel that is important in my mind. While he is in depression, the psalmist asks that question. I mentioned it. He questions himself. He's probing himself. Why are you downcast? What have you been worshiping? What other idols have taken part in your life? Or is it just simply you've missed the sweetness of God? You don't see Him anymore. You don't feel Him anymore. And the most important was, I wanted to further define, and maybe for most of us, further define joy for God's people. And I mentioned that joy for the world, which is a pretty good definition, is it just this emotional response to something great or good with happiness or elation. You're just pumped, you know? And it happens. For whatever reason, you know, you got an A on your test if you're in high school and you thought you were going to fail it. Wow, that's a joyful experience. You buy a new car, some people get pumped at that. Whatever it is. These experiences and these emotions that well up inside of us that produce just this great feelings of elation. You're higher than you felt in a long time. But what I wanted to point out to us was that the psalmist here, he wrote that God was his exceeding joy. 43 verse 4. Then I will go to the altar of God, to God my exceeding joy. And that the psalmist is writing these words in the midst of everything collapsing around him. And I brought up a man that had served and worshipped and tried to do his work in the middle of World War II with Hitler and the Nazis and all that going on. And he wrote this letter about joy to his people. Not his people, but his brothers in the faith. Men that he had trained and raised up in his own seminary as a professor that loved God just as he did. And I'm not going to read the whole letter again, but I wanted to read these words again. This is Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Joy abides with God. It comes down from God and embraces spirit, soul, and body. And where this joy has seized a person, there it spreads. There it carries one away. There it bursts open closed doors. A sort of joy exists that knows nothing at all of the heart's pain, anguish, and dread. It does not last. It can only numb a person for the moment. And that's that worldly idea of joy. The joy of God has gone through the poverty of the manger and the agony of the cross. That is why it is invincible and irrefutable. It does not deny the anguish when it is there, but finds God in the midst of it. In fact, precisely there. It does not deny grave sin, but finds forgiveness precisely within it. It looks death straight in the eye, but finds life precisely within it. What matters is this joy that has overcome. It alone is credible. It alone helps and heals. And that's the joy that God has for us, his people, his children. It's a joy that doesn't numb us from the world. You know, I don't know that I am this man, but you know, you hear stories about these people, these that are called Christians, and hopefully are, but they seem to be totally isolated in a bubble. And you can walk around and kind of just ignore all things around you and become numb to all things around you, even to the point where you don't notice your own sin. And you might say that those people seem happy. And they may even say it themselves, that they're happy. But as the world looks at those people, they don't understand, they don't get that. That's not real. That's not this world. That's not the world we live in. It is riddled by death. It is riddled by sin. It is riddled by the power of darkness. Our lives are marred and broken and they hurt. And that is okay. It's okay to live that way. It's okay to realize that this life is a life that is full of pain. It can be. But what that doesn't mean is that we live without joy. We live apart from joy. And last week, as I showed, like Bonhoeffer and the psalmist, they lived in a world that was crumbling around them. There was, if you were absent from Jesus and you didn't know the gospel, you hadn't experienced the rebirth from the cross and from redemption there, you would find no joy unless you were a Nazi. If you found yourself in those places, joy was gone. And I'm sure Bonhoeffer didn't walk around just elated all the time because he saw destruction everywhere. His family was torn apart. His work was ruined. He couldn't do the thing he so loved to do, which is proclaim God's truth. And then in the end, he was killed because he loved Jesus. And he was trying to rid his people of a plague that was ruining that country. He was murdered. So that joy that we further defined is just simply, we as God's children, no matter what happens, we don't have to live our lives as though we need to be separate from pain, but in the midst of that pain, Jesus Christ, God, he is still God. He is still our hope, and he is our exceeding joy. And we trace all of that back to him. And like I said last week, that was an incomplete. We didn't see everything, but hopefully this week we can shed some light there. So this week we're going to just go, we're just going to run through the whole thing. We're going to go verse by verse, and by verse by verse, I mean kind of like stanza by stanza, if you look at it in song terms. Okay? And we're going to see the psalmist's heart for God while in these great trials, these tough times, and he's in one now. And we're going to observe what he remembers of God's grace as God was lavishing upon him just unparalleled grace. He was experiencing God's love. He was experiencing God's compassion. He was experiencing all of those things, and he felt God there. Then most importantly, we're gonna see who the psalmist knew God to be. Who the psalmist knew God to be. So let's just dig in. Verse 1. As a deer pants for the flowing stream, so pants my soul for you, O God. My soul thirsts for God, for the living God. When shall I come and appear before God? My tears have been my food day and night, while they say to me all the day long, where is your God? These things I remember as I pour out my soul, how I would go with the throng and lead them in procession to the house of God, with glad shouts of song and praise, a multitude-keeping festival. Now, for many of us, I think some of us anyway, have seen a deer kind of doing its thing, like going through the woods, like running, jumping, leaping, just a deer being a deer, right? And if you've seen them, like just running, just headlong in the woods, and they look so graceful and really at one with themselves, it's not awkward for them. It's not like, whoa, he's going to hurt himself, he's going to hit a tree or something. They just love it. That's what they do. That's not the picture here. And once again, I think a lot of us have seen like coffee mugs with this verse on it and maybe even a tie and just like some really just things I wouldn't wear that say on it, as a deer pants for the flowing stream, so pants my soul for you, O God. And you see that picture of a deer standing in this beautiful place, all the greenery, foliage around him, and the stream, just gorgeous stream with shallow, you know, it's just very calm and tranquil. You get the whole effect there, you know. And he looks so happy. It's as a deer pants for the flowing stream, so pants my soul for you, O God. My soul thirsts for God. That is not the picture here. Those people who made that stuff completely missed the mark. That might be the deer's sanctuary, his oasis, the place he wants to be. That is not where he is at. That is not when those words were written. Now picture that graceful deer running through the woods and just loving, being himself. If you can picture that in your mind, does that deer look wounded and panting and out of control? Here we think about the opposite of that picture. Just a deer panting, running for its life. Whatever's happened, maybe it's been hunted and been shot, maybe it's been attacked by something. Maybe it's just been so long without comfort and nourishment that it is lost and it is running erratically. Nothing leading it, no bearings about itself. It's just going and going and going and going. It probably has in its mind's eye that picture of its oasis, that place and source of joy and comfort for it. And so the psalmist goes on to say, that's my soul right now. This is foreign to me. I don't run through the woods and pant like this. Deer know where the water is. They don't really travel that far around from their home spot. They know where their water is. But this deer is gone. It's beyond that. But the deer is just really imagery. It's just trying to teach you and show you in other ways, in other words, what is going on with this man as he's writing this song. His soul is panting for God. That means in his mind's eye, he sees God as the stream, as this place of comfort, of joy, of peace. a place that would strengthen him and nourish him. And he goes on, my soul thirsts for God, for the living God. And you start to see, you start to see this absence of God. He is thirsty for the living God. That means he's not there. Just like the deer can't find the water, he can't find the living God. Can't feel him, he can't sense him. And he goes on, when shall I come and appear before God? And literally this means, when am I going to see you again? When am I going to stand before your face and behold you? The psalmist wants to see God. He wants to feel God. He wants to be in this place with his living God. But he is gone. He's gone. And he goes on, my tears have been my food day and night. Have any of you guys ever, and I can't say that I ever have, but been in that place where God is so gone and you are so ruined that all you want to do is cry? You're not hungry anymore. There's no pains, no longing for food, no other sources of nourishment, just crying. That's where he's at. He's not eating, he's not drinking, he's just simply crying. And that's what sustains his life. That's the point at which he is. While they say to me all the day long, where's your God? And this just adds pain on top of pain. The men, women, children, whoever it is that's around him, rather than lifting up his soul, rather than exalting him to remember his sweet God, his loving God, his steadfast God, they say, where is he gone? And it kind of reminds me of Job, right? When I brought it up last week. He's lost everything. And his wife just gives up, throws in the towel, walks out. Where's your God, Job? And I think many of us would say, I don't know that I've ever been here. Hopefully, it'd be great if many of us could say that. I mean, I felt the distance of God before. I felt like he wasn't in my life before. I've missed the sweetness before. But to this point, I can't say that I've been there. And really what comes to my mind as I read this for one of the first times was this idea of, I don't know if you guys are into like Navy SEALs and that stuff, but the Navy SEALs have this test that's part of their kind of an initiation into the special forces. And it's called waterproofing. They have to be waterproofed. Not literally, like they don't seal them so they keep out water. But it's this test where you have your hands tied behind your back and your ankles bound as well, and you're thrown into a pool of water. And that pool is 20 feet deep sometimes, maybe not quite so deep. And you're in there with no life preservers, no help, no one to aid you. And if you really, really what they're trying to do is gauge, are these men Navy SEALs? Because at that point, when your arms are tied behind your back and your ankles are bound, you're kind of, you're equal. Everyone's equal. You can't do much. It doesn't matter your strength. It doesn't matter how great a swimmer you are. You just can't do much. And so what they try to gauge with this test is, are these men Navy SEALs or not? Do these men want this or not? And so you see people come out of that test, some that are weaklings and seem to be worthless at all these other things, but they're Navy SEALs. They believe it. They have faith that this is what their life is meant for. This is what they're going to do. And you have big, burly men who seem to be the cream of the crop, breaking down and crying and giving up. You see men go to the point of death and they won't throw in the towel. They won't say, I'm done. because they believe I'm that seal. And that came to my mind because this is what God is doing here. He's proofing this guy. He's kind of in some way or another just teaching this man that joy isn't relying on all these extenuating circumstances. Joy is me. Your faith, your love, your drive for who I am and what I am and what I've done, that is what makes you mine. And so you see this war, this back and forth war in these stanzas. So we just saw that the psalmist was broken, God was gone, he was absent. He has no longing to eat and be nourished in any other way other than his tears. And then he says in verse 4, "These things I remember as I pour out my soul." He's talking to God. He's writing these words, and these words just aren't on a piece of paper. These words are his soul being shed before God. He never stops communicating with his God. "How I would go with the throng and lead them in procession to the house of God with glad shouts and songs of praise, a multitude keeping festival." And maybe now you can get a picture of the war. You see this incredibly dark absence, devastated, depressed life. God is gone. And then you see on the other hand this battle coming of the, and of the light, where God in his grace is being just lavished upon this man. He's remembering and calling up these thoughts of he was in a parade walking to the temple, and it was full of people, and there was dancing, and there was singing, and there was instruments, and there was shouts for joy for his God. For his God. And he was part of that. He was part of that. And so, as we go through these stanzas, I've really entitled the sermon, and once again, I don't have slides, but I've entitled the sermon "Deep Calls to Deep," and I draw that from the passage, but you see it. You see these deep thoughts of torment and trial and pain and anguish calling to deep thoughts of joy and peace and comfort and strength. For a while there, I was afraid I was going bonkers because I saw this correlation in the text, and no one else seemed to ever teach it, because I kind of want to check myself and make sure I'm not going nuts. And then finally I saw Spurgeon. He had that same bulb go off. So I trust that I'm not crazy, and this is the Spirit leading me, and he did this with Spurgeon as well. But you see this fight, back and forth fight within this man, these thoughts of sin and death and struggle and pain. And these thoughts of joy and comfort and peace, strength. And then at the end of each stanza, you see the refrain, "Why are you downcast? I know it hurts. I know he's gone. I know he's not here. But I remember. I remember the parade. I remember singing praises. I remember shouting for joy. He is my hope." And then go to verse 6. "My soul is cast down within me. Therefore, I remember you from the land of Jordan and of Hermon, from Mount Mizar." And he's kind of giving us an idea where he is at there. And really, all we need to gather from that is he's far from Jerusalem. He's far from the temple. He's far from that place, which he is associating in the psalm with a place where he meets God. He's far from there. "And then deep calls to deep. At the roar of your waterfalls, all of your breakers and your waves have gone over me." I don't know if you've noticed by now, but I love these illustrations and these stories in the scripture that involve the sea and the water, and it's just untamedness, if that's a word. And here, once again, just like many places, the psalmist uses this as an illustration. And here's also where the waterproofing really made sense to me. "At the roar of your waterfalls, all of your breakers and your waves have gone over me." Like it's amazing. And we were in Squamish. We went up to Squamish visiting Canada. James and Nikki there, and we took Noah and Anna. We all went to Shannon Falls, which is this really beautiful waterfall. But it's amazing to stand back at the base of this mountain. And you see these huge rocks, and then all around are these massive trees that have been there for a long, long time. And you see this water just cascading down, just looks amazing. I don't really know. I can't explain what it does inside of you, but you're just like, wow. You're just in awe of that. And then to know God made that. But the picture here is he's picturing the roar. The imagery is the roar of it. How unsettling that might be. It's almost as if he was on this stream where it's flattened out and it's kind of turned into glass and it's just gorgeous. It's peaceful. He's just floating along, but then he hears this roar begin and it just deepens and deepens. And then he sees this mist, this huge mist in front of him, and he's scared to death. That roar is unsettling. That roar is life-changing. All your breakers and your waves have gone over me. And then he starts to use this illustration of the sea, where this man is on the sea, and it's not a peaceful thing. It's once again painful. It's scary. And it's visualizing, and you're not in control. And he talks about the breakers and the waves, and they're going over him. They don't stop. Just continue on. He goes up and he goes down and the waves just slam him. Can't breathe. He can't get away. He can't relieve himself from the situation. He is there. Just keeps coming. Wave after wave. Once again, you get this isolatedness. He can't control his situation. His peace, his comfort has left him. By day, the Lord commands his steadfast love, and at night, his song is with me, a prayer to the God of my life. There's that war again. By day, the Lord commands his steadfast love, and at night, his song is with me, a prayer to the God of my life. See that deep, those deep moments when he is out of control, he is going and hurting and lost, and then you see these other moments when God is there. Deep calling to deep. And he goes on, verse 9, I say to God, my rock, why have you forgotten me? God was everything that this man stood on. And yet the rock seems to have disappeared. Doesn't care about his situations, doesn't care how he's being tossed to and fro. And it's interesting, he calls God in verse 8, his steadfast love. He's with me, he's my steadfast love. At night, prayer to the God of my life. And then in here, it's, why have you forgotten me? He's gone once again, he's not there, he can't feel him, he can't see him. And that's causing him to, why do I go about mourning because of the oppression of the enemy? You're my rock, but you're gone. As with a deadly wound in my bones, my adversaries taunt me while they say to me all the day long, where's your God? And there if you, now put that with the deer. Here he is, he's going about, he's forgotten, he's mourning with a deadly wound in his bones. He's running for his life. He's looking for his life for the God, his rock. The God, his God in the steadfast love. But when he is gone, he feels as though he's wounded. He's not whole. He's not himself. He's not healthy. So this absence of God for this man feels as though he's been attacked. And one of the few Psalms where men write like this, where he is, as far as we can tell, not in threat of his life. He just has these people around him just continually questioning him. Where's your God? Why hasn't he delivered you from this? Why isn't he your rock now? Where's your God? And this absence of God produces in this man a brokenness. He calls it, as with a deadly wound in my bones. He feels as though he's dying. And then once again, there's that pain on top of pain. Where's your God? Those people that God has placed around him, they're no help at all. Where is your God? And then there again, the preaching. Why are you cast down, O my soul, and why are you in turmoil within me? Hope in God, for I shall again praise him, my salvation and my God. Vindicate me, O God, and defend my cause against an ungodly people. From the deceitful and unjust man, deliver me. So you see that these people around him, that they're ungodly, they don't love God, they aren't lifting him up, they're not exalting him towards his God, but rather they're deceitful, they're unjust, they're fooling him, they're robbing him of everything around them that should be pointing him to joy, and he's allowing them to do so. We're going to see that a little bit more later. And so he's asking God, he's crying out to God, his rock who has forgotten him, vindicate me, O God, and defend my cause against these ungodly people who don't love you, don't know you, won't talk about you, won't praise you, won't send me to you. From the deceitful and unjust man, deliver me, for you are the God in whom I take refuge. Why have you rejected me? So here he is, this man who knows God, whose God is his joy. And he says, in the midst of these people who don't know God, who are deceitful and unjust, why are you rejecting me right now? Why in these moments are you allowing me to go around as though I'm wounded and broken and near death? He goes on, why do I go about mourning because of the oppression of the enemy? He asks himself a question, why? Why is it so important that the enemy and their oppression cease? Why would it make all the difference in the world if the people around me were lifting me up to you rather than questioning if you were even real? Now, for some reason, this kind of struck a chord in me. Because for a long time, everyone in my life, and I remember from a fairly young age and up into high school, like I was on a search. I knew that there was something in my life missing. Didn't know it was the gospel. Didn't know it was Jesus. Didn't know I was a sinner. Didn't know all that. Didn't know that was what I was searching for. And for some reason, the people around me, that's where I found soul, you know, just a place of rest, place of peace. I cared about what they say. I cared about what they thought. And you would say things like, God wouldn't give you more than you can handle. Or, all things happen for a reason. You know, common cliches. Things I didn't necessarily believe, didn't necessarily understand. But, okay, you know, right. But here's this man, and he's unlike me, he knew God. Unlike me, he knew the source of everything. And we're going to see this. And for some reason in this situation, it seems to matter what these people think. It seems to have some bearing on what he's feeling and what he is going through, on what the people around him feel and think about his God. But then he asks himself the question, why do I go about mourning because of this oppression? Because these people simply don't know my God. They don't love my God. They don't worship my God. And of course, they won't exalt me towards Him. And then this is that turning point that we saw last week. So send out your light and your truth and let them lead me. Let them bring me to your holy hill and to your dwelling. Then I will go to the altar of God, to God my exceeding joy, and I will praise you with a lyre, O God my God. So you see these massive battles of these incredibly deep pains. And then you see these massive welling ups of hope and peace and strength in God. You see this deep calling to this deep. And I don't want us to miss it. There is deep pain. Our lives are going to be full of it. But this whole idea that I wanted to share with you is that there's also a deep joy that is never ceasing, never ending. And just as pain we will never know the fullness of, we will never experience the end of joy. It is everlasting. Just as the sin of God's wrath is bottomless, or the hatred in God's wrath towards sin is bottomless. So, how was the psalmist able to write this song and see God? And how did he understand God? And this is that quote. I botched it last week, but this is A.W. Tozer. What comes into our minds when we think about God is the most important thing about us. And I would say this is absolutely true. I don't care how many. And this was an amazing thing that the kids were able, those three were able to recite the Ten Commandments. But that's not the most important thing. It doesn't matter if you have the entire New Testament memorized. It doesn't matter if you can memorize all the Psalms. It doesn't matter if you can memorize the Pauline, the letters of Paul. It doesn't matter if you have Revelation memorized. It doesn't matter if you can draw out a chart of how everything works in the Scriptures. It doesn't matter if you're a theologian and you've gone to seminary. It doesn't matter. None of that matters. What matters is your view of God. It matters what you know about God. So when we come to the Scriptures, when we read things like this, we don't want to gloss over and just bring into ourselves what makes sense. We want to search for God there. When people ask us questions and we go through situations and we can bring up, this is God here. I see God here. This is why God would do that. And we know God. That is what is most important. So this quote, what comes into our minds when we think about God is the most important thing about us is true. It is. I don't care if you read a verse a day. You can know 10 times more than people that read way more than that about God. What comes to your mind when you think about God? Now quickly, I want us to just walk back through here again and just start to see what the psalmist knew of God, what he knew God to be. And right away, what comes to my mind is if you step back and you look at this whole thing in just one big picture, is that the psalmist knew God was omniscient. He was in control. He was omnipotent. All these things that are going on here seem to just kind of do their thing. All of the illustrations, all of the things going on in this man's life, they kind of seem to be free agents just walking around doing their thing. But what's important here is the psalmist understands that they're simply fulfilling God's path for their life. God has a plan. His foreknowledge is there. His providence is there. And it's all being fulfilled. So he uses the deer and the flowing stream, both of which the deer is not in control of the flowing stream. The deer can't make that stream appear in front of him when he is weary and dying and panting. That deer does not control the stream. But that stream is exactly where it has been placed, and that deer is on its path, on a path that has been marked for him. And he goes on and he talks about, "My soul pants for you, O God. My soul thirsts for the living God." You start to understand this idea that he is searching to see God again, to feel God again, to know God again, but God, he is the one that's in control. God knows the situation. He hasn't completely left him, though he feels this way. But for some reason, God has stood at a distance. The psalmist, just like the deer, cannot make God appear. And then these things I remember as I pour out my soul. How I would go with the throng and lead them in procession to the house of God with glad shouts and songs of praise, a multitude-keeping festival. We understand that he sees God as this God that has made a people that love him, that worship him, that sing to him, that have parades for him. And that we understand that these people rightly see God, and that is why they do this. That God is a God that is worthy to be praised. You go on. "Why are you cast down on my soul, and why are you in turmoil within me? Hope in God." He's not hoping in anything else around him. His hope is God. Because he knows, the psalmist knows, while in the midst of everything crumbling, although he can't control anything in his life, that God will never change. That his hope will always be there. That is why he hopes in God. In the middle of everything failing, his hope is God. And then he goes on and again praise him. God is the one who he prays. God is his salvation. From this pain, from this turmoil, from this life and longing, God is his salvation. He doesn't see that parade. He doesn't see the temple. He doesn't see all the people around him just lifting him towards God to be salvation. He sees God as his salvation. He sees God to be everywhere. "Therefore my soul is cast down within me. Therefore I remember you from the land of Jordan and Hermon, from Mount Mizar." God is there. "Deep calls to deep at the roar of your waterfalls. All of your breakers and your waves have gone over me." There again, you get this, in this illustration, he is in this place. These breakers and these waves are overtaking him. He's on this path heading towards this roaring waterfall, which can take his life. But whose are they? They're God's. "All of your waterfalls, all your breakers and your waves have gone over me." The psalmist sees God as completely in control. Although he alone himself can do nothing, he can't save his life, God is in control. And he commands them to go over him, to take him. By day, the Lord commands his steadfast love, and at night his song is with me, a prayer to the God of my life. God is the one who holds his life. In fact, he says that God is his life. Not his kids, not his job, not his success, not how great of a song this was going to be, but God is his life. God is his steadfast love. And this is why I say you don't let these words just kind of go. The psalmist knew, although he felt no love, he knew that God was a God of steadfast love. Now, that steadfastness is very important because that means it's going nowhere. It is firmly anchored in the life of this man, his steadfast love. He just simply didn't feel it, but it was there. He knew God was a God of steadfast love. He knew God was his rock. Once again, calling back to this unchanging, unwavering, very powerful God, in whom we can rest, in whom we can take sanctuary, in whom we can draw strength from. He was his rock. In verse 10, you get this idea that God is what makes him whole. God is what makes him whole. Because when God was gone and absent in his life, he felt as though he was dead. So he equates this absent with God with not being whole. So therefore, God makes him whole. And there again, he starts to say, God is my hope. God is hope. He is salvation. He is worthy of praise. 43:1, he is the vindicator and the defender of his people. God alone will vindicate his people. God alone defends his people. You and I are no more in control of the people around us than they are over you. God is in control. God is his refuge. Verse 2, for you, the God in whom I take refuge. God is his light. God is his truth. God is the one who leads him. God is the one who has his dwelling place and brings his people there. God is his exceeding joy. So you begin to see as you just go through the scripture, any scripture, and you just draw from it. Who has God fashioned himself to be here? How is God revealing himself here? The psalmist was able to make it through this proofing of his life for joy and for peace and for strength in God because he knew God. Had faith in God. His hope was God. It wasn't anything else around him. And so it is with us that anything and everything around us might fail, but God will not. Our joy can firmly be found in God if we know him. The enemy, as pictured here, is in our lives as well. We have oppression, we have pain, we have suffering. Sin comes, death comes. Failure comes. But God is our rock. God is our refuge. God is our joy. All those things, and in this psalm, all of this pain can be traced back to God. The psalmist saw God as the providential God that declared everything from of old and chose all of us from of old. We were in his heart before he made us. The path that we are on, he had written before we were made. The waterfalls, the rivers, the waves, the things that break us and hurt us and wound us, he is in control of them. The people who stand around us and we fellowship with and many times don't know God, he is in control of them. He places us in their midst. He's the one that removes us from our home, just like he did to St. Patrick, and he sends us to other lands. He is the one who allows wars to rise. He is the one who will constantly and without ceasing lead us back to Him. I want to read this again, 77:19. Your way was through the sea, your path through the great waters, yet your footprints were unseen. You led your people like a flock. It doesn't always make sense. It doesn't always feel right. But He is always there and He is always in control. The psalmist was able to write the psalm because he knew whatever had come was from God. He was able to have this exceeding joy and write these words because he knew God was there. And so all I really want for us is that we, as we study and read and pray and strive to know God more, that we could write a song like this when pain comes. And that like me and many of you, whenever that cloud just is lifted and that pain is gone, you realize that God was always there. And that He is back with His grace and His mercy in beautiful ways. And like I wanted just to fall off my bicycle and worship and cry right there, that you can wherever you are at. And before I pray, me and Abby went to a concert a couple of weeks ago and I heard the song really for the first time. I'm sure I heard it before that. But it really seemed to go with this song. And so I asked her to get it done. And all week long she was worried she wasn't going to do that. But she finished it and she's going to play it this morning and sing it. But we're going to do it twice. The first time I'm asking that you just really sit there and be still and think about God. Just pray, reveal your heart to Him. And just talk to Him. And then she'll sing it through again. And if you get done before that, you can stand up and sing. But at that point, I would ask, you know, if you're not done, keep going. But if you are done, stand up and sing. And just praise the God of your life. So I'll pray and we'll go. Father, I thank You for Your love. Thank You that You showed Your love in such a way that You sent Your Son down to die and pay for us, to raise again, to save us and to set us free from the sin and the sorrow and the pain in this world that destroys. That You came so that You could set us free to know You, to know that You are the God of our joy, to know that You are the God of our life. So, Father, I just ask this morning that we as Your people, as Your children, would be strengthened. Help us to find those oases where You are in our lives and just to wait there. Just to think on You there, to worship You there. And then as we are away and we are in the dry and weary land, the deserts, that You would be our source of strength as we remember those oases. Father, I pray all of these things in Your Son's name for Your glory and for our joy.